The Naples Council on World Affairs welcomes Daniel Markey, author of China's Western Horizon, Beijing and the New Geopolitics of Eurasia. This is a tantalizing title that suggests a new regional landscape is emerging, one of historic transformation, and one that will challenge U.S. thinking and, as Dr. Markey suggests, will perhaps push the U.S. to recalibrate our role in the world. As China's Belt and Road Initiative continues to expand and Kazakhstan, Pakistan, and Iran continue to profit from that very expansion, so should our knowledge and interest in this new neighborhood. And clearly, we have the right tutor, as Dr. Markey will share his knowledge of this region with us today. Academic Director of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, their Global Policy Program, and Senior Research Professor, Dr. Markey is a graduate of Johns Hopkins University in International Studies and received his PhD in Political Studies from Princeton University. Welcome back to Naples, Dan.
Thank you, and thanks to all of you for joining in. And thanks to the Naples World Affairs Council as a whole for making this possible, and to me especially for making this work. So today I'm going to talk about China's Western Horizon, and I guess I'll go for about a half an hour or so, and then we'll open up to Q&A. Great. So this book just came out this past year, and its origins are really with my work on South Asia. So specifically my prior book on Pakistan US relations. And I started thinking about the core topic of this new book probably about a decade ago, possibly longer, as I was thinking about developments in South Asia that were new and different. And at the front or the leading edge of that, in my mind, was the greater influence of China, and especially China in its relationship with Pakistan, but also the implications that that would have for the rest of the region. So I started thinking about it then, and I decided that that was something I wanted to pursue further, that my last book really didn't allow me to dive in deeply enough to it. And for this book, it has multiple pieces to it, but just kind of to give you some flavor, each of the main chapters opens with a brief but deeper dive into the longer history of China's involvement, or in some cases, relative lack of involvement in parts of continental Eurasia, which is the focus of the book. So, you know, going back hundreds, if not in some cases, thousands of years to China's relations in South Asia, then shifting over to Central Asia, and then heading into the Middle East. So I try to give that sweep of history to put the current era into some context. The book also has a fair amount of what I would describe as sort of basic data, sort of what's actually happening. What does the region look like economically, in a security sense, politically, and so on? And how is China's role shifting in all of these areas? And the book is informed in many ways, not just by my book research, but also by a wide range of interviews that I conducted over the years in Washington and elsewhere in the United States, but also in my travels across most of the countries that I focus on in the book. The only country that gets a lot of attention in the book where I wasn't able to go is Iran, where I didn't feel that it was possible for me to travel as I was doing this research. But I had fantastic opportunities to go to places like in Kazakhstan, up along the border with China, to see the trade hub, the dry port at Horgos, which is right at the border of Kazakhstan and China. I spent a fair amount of time in Pakistan. I was able to go to Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Middle East to interview there. So I had a chance to get to see some of these things firsthand. And of course, the book is also informed by my own background. It has, I'm trained in as an academic in political science. I teach that at Johns Hopkins now, but it also is really intended to appeal to people who are more policy oriented. And that reflects the time that I spent at the State Department, at the Council on Foreign Relations, and reflects the interests of most of my students, most of my audience now where I teach at SAIS. And it's an attempt to pull it all together to make sense of an enormously large range of developments in a region on the other side of the world. It crosses politics and economics and security and strategic issues across continental Eurasia. And if you're considering a map, everything from the west of China or China's western border all the way to the doorstep of Western Europe across that vast sweep of continental Eurasia. But it also makes a very central argument about the need to think locally, not to think of this region as simply a playground for outside powers like China or the United States, but to think and to understand more deeply the interests of the peoples, of the states, of the various actors that are occupying and live in this part of the world. So it's not a macro level analysis. It attempts to be more of a micro level analysis and then to play that out over time and space, which is not easy because there's so much going on. So what the book tries to do is in many cases break this down into different stories. And it opens with a story, which I thought, as I learned it myself, was indicative of a wider truth in the region. And it's the story of Gwadar Port, this port along the Arabian sea coast of Pakistan. And it's a relatively new deep sea port, which got China's backing, financial backing and technical backing, in around January 2000, when the then head of Pakistan, the leader, General and President Pervez Musharraf, traveled to Beijing and asked his Chinese counterparts if they would fund and support the development of this deep sea port. And as that was initially, this story was initially related to me by a Chinese diplomat. It was explained to me that that this took the Chinese side by surprise. Now, that point took me by surprise because sitting in Washington, D.C., many of us had perceived Gwadar Port as one of a number of strategic nodes along the Indo-Pacific rim, often described as a string of pearls, where China was intentionally expanding its access and its influence militarily or otherwise. And so I had assumed that this was a kind of a Chinese plan baked in Beijing, brought to Pakistan, and then if not imposed, at least made palatable to Pakistani audiences. But in reality, this was a Pakistani plan that was brought to Beijing and took the Chinese side by surprise. Their immediate reaction was one of, why would we want to build a port there? It's not commercially viable. It's connected to almost nothing inside of Pakistan by road or rail. It's in a difficult part of Pakistan where there's an active separatist movement, a violent separatist movement. And initially, at least, the Chinese didn't see the strategic value to it. So what this story taught to me was the centrality of local agency, of the interests of local players like Pakistan, even if they were the weaker partner in a relationship with China. And so the strategic vision was Musharraf's, or at least was a Pakistani vision, a vision which was basically driven by the idea that having a Chinese-backed port in Pakistan would be useful as Pakistan contemplated a potential war with India. It would offer Pakistan an alternative port to Karachi and a means to stem the flow of Indian shipping into the Persian or near up into the Persian Gulf. And that was useful from Musharraf's perspective. It also had a developmental agenda, an idea of building out a new major piece of infrastructure inside of Pakistan in one of its least developed provinces. The barriers to success of this project so far have also been principally local. The Baloch separatists, that is the locals themselves, haven't seen the value of Gwadar Port, and in many cases have even attacked it violently, have attacked Chinese workers, have attacked hotels, have attacked road crews, Pakistani road crews, as they were in the business of trying to build this out. And so the local conditions on the ground have, in many cases, stalled, stymied, or at least delayed this project. Simultaneously, though, as we look over the past now 2 decades, we can see this is also a story of Chinese strategic opportunism. So while Beijing didn't immediately appreciate the potential value of this port, over time it has come, it seems, to appreciate the greater value of it. And now Guaderport looks to be more and more possibly another one of this so-called string of pearls. In other words, even if the Chinese didn't appreciate it at the outset, they have come to see some strategic value, have continued to invest in it, and have at various points reinforced and restated their commitment to building out this port in spite of these local realities. And so what we see here is a little bit complicated, but it's the push and pull, or the tug of Chinese interests and the push of Pakistani interests, or vice versa, and their interactive effect is what drives the story on the ground. And that is a story that I see repeating with very different details. The specifics are always quite different, but I see that story repeating itself across this vast region. So China and China's influence is a big news story, the big news story for continental Eurasia, a change that has not just generational consequence, but perhaps even millennial level consequence for this region. But how that big news story will play depends on local interests. And sitting in Washington, what I have found is too often we are principally focused on the question of what does China want? What is Beijing doing? What is their grand scheme? And not nearly as much time on what do the locals want? What do they want from China? How do they perceive China? And we need to understand both. So in this book, I have several broad aims. For American readers, so I imagine are my main audience, I also want to have them appreciate the connections across continental Eurasia. I mean, when we think even just of China, we tend to think of China as an East Asian power. Ask most Americans, even experts, and they'll talk mainly about China's relations with Taiwan, with Japan, with Korea, along the now Indo-Pacific, so even bleeding into India, but are much less conversant in the connections, the interconnections between China and Central Asia, and certainly not between China and the Middle East. But these are increasingly important. And if you simply stop to look at a map, you'll see that Western China is closer to Central Asia than it is to the Pacific Ocean. And in some cases, and if you look at that map further to the west, you'll see just how close it is to the Middle East as well. Not something that we're used to thinking about. I do also use the book to try to explain what I think China is up to, what motivates Beijing, because as I say, these are important, and try to extend that conversation well beyond the current fascination, I would say even fixation, with this Belt and Road Initiative, which is a catch-all umbrella for much of what China is doing, but often focuses too much on infrastructure development and not nearly enough on military relations, on technological innovations and aspirations, and on the politics that is bringing Beijing closer to many of these states. So that's something else I want to talk about. And then finally, the book closes with some suggestions about what all this means for the United States. What does it mean for us in terms of our interests in places like South Asia or the Middle East? And what does it mean for our broader geopolitical competition, which is clearly coming together with China and is likely to be the dominant story, broadly geopolitical story of this century? So if I dive in a little bit more deeply, as I say, this book fixes on the question of the agency of local states. So how their aspirations and interests affect their relations with China. And the 3 case studies, as I say, are South Asia, Central Asia, and the Middle East. And so here I focus in South Asia to further boil down this complicated story. I focus on Pakistan, which is China's principal partner in South Asia. In Central Asia, I focus on Kazakhstan, hydrocarbon-rich, very large, swath of territory that has a border, a shared border with China. And in the Middle East, I mainly focus on Iran, although I spend a fair amount of time on Saudi Arabia as well. And in each one of these cases, I ask two broad sets of questions to try to get at what's going on. So the first set of questions is, what's happening on the home front? What is happening inside these states domestically in terms of, and how their relations with China are affecting that? And I boil that down into sort of even crudely into the simple question of who wins and who loses from more Chinese involvement in each state. Now, in some cases, it's more relative. It's who wins and who wins more and who wins less and who maybe actually loses. But it's always a question of relative gains because ultimately politics is not just about if something is good or bad, but who gains more out of it. And in each of these societies, all of the ones that I look at closely, there are existing divisions within them, cleavages, socioeconomic differences that are, I think, likely to be exacerbated by Chinese involvement. So an example of this, in Kazakhstan, you have an elite dominated, a narrow elite dominated society, strongman rule. Nazarbayev has been in charge since the independence of Kazakhstan from the former Soviet Union. And these elites, those that small circle around Nazarbayev, were effectively bailed out by Chinese loans and investments in 2008, 2009. So they're the clear winners out of this. And as we see over time, they have found themselves more and more in bed economically, commercially, in terms of loans and debt with the Chinese, whereas the broad public has been more skeptical about China's involvement in Kazakhstan. Another example, coming back to Pakistan, those separatists in Balochistan, you know, the Chinese investment in Gwadar Port and the area around that is kind of like a gentrification project where, you know, which frequently happens, where you get a development agenda that is likely to bring significant wealth and building and so on into an area of poverty, but where the locals benefit almost not at all. And studies that have tried to discern this in the case of Gwadar and Balochistan have found that the locals are getting basically nothing out of this port development deal. If anything, many of them are being displaced from traditional fishing grounds and other areas. And therefore, it's not surprising that they would, in many cases, oppose this development altogether and see China as a threat, not a help. And another example would be in Iran, where what we've seen is Chinese investments in surveillance technology, in telecommunications technology. China's building out of Iran's internet has enabled the clerical regime, that already repressive political regime, to further crack down on opposition in ways that they weren't able to do before, and with further Chinese assistance, are likely to do it even better looking into the future. So in each case, what we see is local leaders, in all three of these cases, benefiting principally from Chinese involvement, but upsetting broader segments of the public. And that's worrisome. If you're concerned about the political stability of these types of countries, you will raise questions, deeper questions, as I try to do in the book, about what the long-term implications of this will be. So that's one set of questions. What's happening inside each society? The other set of questions is, how is China's involvement likely to affect the relations between each of these countries and their principal allies, adversaries, and neighbors? So in many of these instances, what you see is leaders of these countries, statesmen, are looking to China as a potential patron, protector, benefactor, insulator from outside pressure. Look to, in the case of South Asia, Pakistan sees China as what might be called an external balancer against India. And that raises questions about whether China's involvement is likely to create forces for greater stability in South Asia or greater instability. And from what my reading of the developments, what we see is that by backing Pakistan, China runs the risk of, you might say, emboldening Pakistan to be more risk acceptant in its dealings with India, and simultaneously makes India very wary and skeptical about what China is doing in its nearby neighborhood, and very nervous about that. India's wariness and Pakistan's emboldenment is a dangerous cocktail, a dangerous combination in an already difficult neighborhood. And what we have seen just over the past several years is only the ratcheting up of tensions between not just India and Pakistan, but also India and China. And I don't think that these developments can be separated out from the broader reality of China's greater involvement in the region. If we shift now to Central Asia, the story is different, but it has some similar dynamics. China here has mixed interests. It is simultaneously eager to court the energy-rich countries like Kazakhstan as partners, but it also wants to keep a kind of a good and possibly improving relationship with Russia if it can, principally because on the global geopolitical map, it sees Russia as a partner against the West, against the United States. And Russia is eager to play a similar game. And what we've seen over the past decade or so is what is often described as a division of labor between Russia and China in Central Asia, where Russia has the gun, that is, continues to be the principal external security partner, and China has the purse, that is, it is the principal economic partner. And that division of labor seems to be holding up reasonably well, at least for now. The question then to be raised is whether over time, as China becomes more and more dominant in an economic sense, whether that dominance bleeds into politics and then increasingly into security as well, displacing Russia and in time creating frictions with Moscow. And so the question I raise there is, will Russia wake up to the threat in Central Asia to its dominance posed by China in time to do anything about it? Or will Russia, Moscow, be so occupied, preoccupied with what it considers the threat posed by the West, by the United States, that it will go too long in working with China and never wake up in time to do anything about China's involvement in Central Asia? And this, of course, creates a very tricky balancing act for the Central Asian states themselves, who really depend on external relationships to maintain their own internal sovereignty. That is, they play a balancing act of all the external players so that no single player will dominate them. And that's what they're eager to do. But as China's role increases, that's going to be a harder balancing act to play. And then if we shift to the Middle East, here we see China's involvement in what has always, or nearly always, been a messy and very violent region. You see China courted by all of the players of the region. China as a buyer, principal buyer of hydrocarbon energy, of oil and gas. And so both Iran and the Saudis and their Gulf allies see China as essential to their long-term economic success, and in most cases, even their short-term survival, especially for Iran. But they also are eager to gain from Chinese investment in their other schemes in terms of economic diversification schemes, building out their infrastructure and their technology. And increasingly, they're also inclined to see the potential that China offers to be a principal seller of arms and military technologies, displacing Russia, I think, likely over time. And in some cases, providing technologies, sensitive technologies like nuclear-capable missiles or armed drones that the United States is unwilling to sell to them, to the region. So without breaking a serious sweat, China finds itself in the luxurious spot of not having to choose between being in bed with the Iranians or in bed with the Saudis. They can, and even the Israelis, they can be have all of them as partners and benefit from the opportunities that provides and extend their influence into a region which, as you know, has historically been one of significant American involvement at a relatively low cost. Okay, so that's driven, again, by localized developments, not necessarily by a grand scheme developed in Beijing, but by the eagerness of these local partners to draw China into the region. So understanding these localized regions is really essential, as I say. But of course, this shouldn't be too surprising to us. I mean, the United States has always had to think about local interests as its own influence extended globally. And it's true for all rising powers with global ambitions like China. But it's complicated. And so we want to look at these local tendencies. And as much as is possible, as I've sketched out how different they are, we also want to look for patterns. And that's where I'll wrap up. Because if we look across the region, what we can see is this is generally a mixed economic story for the United States. So here I'll step back and look at this through the Washington, D.C.-based lens. What does this mean for us? Economically, it's a mixed story. There are some pros, some benefits to greater Chinese investment in the region. There have been American companies and commercial opportunities that will benefit. GE selling turbines to be used in Pakistani plants that are financed by the Chinese, for instance. There are ways to piggyback off of and benefit from the rising tide of first investment and then hopefully over time, economic development in the region. But there are also, I think, significant cons to what China is doing. There is the potential long-term threat to what you might describe as Chinese lock-in into these economies, either because the standards that are adopted in these countries are Chinese standards, the technologies are Chinese technologies, the markets are increasingly captured by Chinese goods, the trade tends to flow to and from China, and because in all of this, the pressures for what we would consider to be healthy economic reform programs are alleviated because the Chinese have come in and in some cases are bailing out these economies without forcing the types of reforms that we might like to see. So a mixed story economically, but with some long-term concerns. Politically, I'm concerned that this Chinese influence really creates headaches for Washington. It undermines any kind of agenda that would be opening to more liberal tendencies within most of these states, which tend to be illiberal or undemocratic. If strongmen in a country like Kazakhstan can count on the Chinese to back them up, then what is the reason to broaden the base of politics within a society? To the contrary, there's every incentive to continue to hold on to the power that you have. And this fits in with a broader concern that many of us have about what you might call an authoritarian surge or a retreat of democracy globally, the problems of illiberal repression that we're seeing that is in many ways aided and abetted by Chinese technologies. We don't expect Beijing to ever be a champion of democracy anywhere, or a protector of human rights or liberal values, and that's certainly not going to happen in Eurasia. And then on the security front, here too, as I mentioned, there's little reason to be optimistic that China's greater involvement in the region will pacify the region. That is, it's playing up or intensifying some of the very regional conflicts that predated its involvement. So whether that's India versus Pakistan or Saudi Arabia versus Iran, all of these things, these dynamics gain new life and potentially Chinese weapons and Chinese resources to back them up. So it's not a dampening of regional conflict. And simultaneously, it is also, as I mentioned in the case of the Port of Gwadar, but in other cases as well, it opens a long-term potential for Chinese power projection capability, military power projection capability across this vast continent, all the way up to Western Europe's doorstep, which is something that the United States will have to contemplate, even as it is contemplating and attempting to shift its emphasis more eastward to what we're calling the Indo-Pacific. We'll have to think about the consequences for China's westward shift across this vast space and what that will mean for us over time. So let me leave it there. I hope I've covered enough ground to raise some questions and to prompt a bit of discussion. And I'll look forward to that now. Thank you.
Well, Dan, thank you very much. And you certainly did land on quite a few runways here to give us an opportunity to ask questions. Mark, do you have a question?
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to say I really enjoyed the book. I thought it was great. Could you just maybe, what I thought was interesting in the book is you talked about the Maldives and about the basically the debt, the utilities, and then India comes into it. So could you just go into that a little bit?
Yeah. So Maldives, come into the story in a way that is tries to reflect the opportunism of Chinese expansion of power and involvement across this region, but also the reality of local politics and how that can kind of upset the apple cart of Chinese plans and aspirations, or at least delay it in ways that were unanticipated. So, and the Maldives are potentially strategically important because it's an island chain, a string of islands, that India would be concerned about an expanded Chinese presence on. So it's got a strategic component, a political component, and an economic component because the Chinese were investing in the Maldives and attempting to, in effect, buy up and expand their presence, they claim, for tourists, for Chinese tourists, but also with the potential for some other use. So you put all these pieces together, and what you get is, first of all, I wanted to give a corrective to a storyline that's often raised, both about the Maldives and about Sri Lanka, where it is often claimed that these have been seen as, as I said about Gwadar Port, as spaces on the map that China identified and wanted to plant its flag, effectively in a vaguely colonial fashion, but certainly a strategic one, and buy up a presence so as to use it to extend its influence, without thinking about how the door was opened to that possibility because of local leaders. These local leaders who effectively reached out to China and were looking for bailouts, were looking for loans, were looking for development. And in the case of the Maldives, were looking, I think, for some more corrupt purpose to make their own, to benefit themselves. So that side of that story needs to be appreciated because I don't think that it was a brilliant strategist sitting in Beijing, looking around on the map and saying, putting his finger, that's where we need to go, but more of a request. So a push and a pull connection there. But then you had elections in the Maldives. And I tell a similar story in Malaysia in the book too. You have elections that throw the leaders out and bring in a different, in this case, more pro-Indian leader who's inclined to effectively limit China's involvement in the Maldives. And that too is an important story because it suggests that China, first of all, probably didn't do a very good job anticipating politics on the ground. And we've seen that story in a number of other instances too. And we can also see where these local dynamics will make China's job much harder. And we need to understand, they're not acting in a vacuum. They're not all powerful. And they are sensitive to those political pressures too. So those are the reasons why I tell the story of the Maldives, a tiny country in and of itself, maybe less important, except for the lessons that it can teach us about these dynamics.
Bill, you had your hand up. Do you want to still continue your question?
Yes, I also enjoyed the book a lot. It was particularly instructive of what's going on in the rest of the world besides China. And that was very helpful. Could you elaborate a little more on, on Sri Lanka? I think that was one of the most interesting stories about how a corrupt leader, was able to get China to build these ports and then was thrown out. And now the new leader has been thrown out again. Could you kind of go through some details on that?
Right. So it's actually a similar story to the Maldives in that, at least in the way that I've seen it, The Rajapaksa regime of Sri Lanka reached out to the Chinese for multiple purposes, not least to help them win a civil war that had really devastated Sri Lanka for generations, and which was tearing the country apart. And the Rajapaksa regime, which, you know, seen in Washington, a relatively harder line, less liberal, more authoritarian regime, was eager to win that war and was unable to get the types of tools, military tools and so on, that it needed to do so to crush the opposition forces militarily, but turned to China and successfully managed to do that. And in the context of that success, brought about an opportunity, not just for the sort of the unification of Sri Lanka under a more centralized and less divided rule, but also brought in the possibility of far greater Chinese investment and involvement politically. And that worried not just the United States, but probably more importantly, worried India, Sri Lanka's nearby neighbor, and traditionally its dominant regional player there. And so India became quite concerned about this. And one of the centerpieces of what the Chinese were proposing to do was, and actually were invested in, was to build out a port, the Hambantota port. Important piece of that is Hambantota port, located in effectively the hometown of the Sri Lanka's leader. And so this was a port, not, again, kind of like Gwadar, in that it was not a port that the Chinese necessarily would have picked if left to their own devices, but because the leader of Sri Lanka was looking for effectively a development scheme in his hometown that would win him political points at home and demonstrate that China had his back, and probably line his pockets as well, he opened that possibility to Beijing. They were more than happy to take advantage of that. But not only that, when it turned out that the Sri Lankans were unable to repay the loans, the debts were too high, this is what caught the world's attention, because what we got is what is now being described as debt trap diplomacy, which is that the Sri Lankans found themselves unable to repay. And so the Chinese said, okay, well, what we'll do is we'll trade equity for debt. That is, if you hand over a long-term lease of this port, then we would be willing to forgive those loans. And that raises all kinds of concerns and alarms, not just in Sri Lanka, but globally, about what China is really up to. If China is entering into these development schemes with an underhanded purpose of effectively forcing states to deliver territory when they cannot repay the loans, then we have a new version of a kind of a colonial practice, or at least that's the fear. So Sri Lanka became the poster child for that concern. But as the story went, the Rajapaksa regime was kicked out in elections. New government comes in and reverses course, or attempts to, finds itself in a bind because of its poor economic situation, but is able to renegotiate with the Chinese. Lots of other things go on in Sri Lanka. It's an unstable political period. And eventually now Rajapaksa comes back. His family is back in power and back to doing business with the Chinese. So these are the kinds of games that are likely to play out across the region, and not just in the region in Asia, but are happening in Africa, in Latin America, and elsewhere. And the question is, how much of it is premeditated by the Chinese? How much of it is opportunistic? And how much of it is subject to local pressures? And my point to wrap it up here is that the local side of the story continues to be far more important than we give it credit. Another election in Sri Lanka, and we could see the Rajapaksa's kicked out again, and China will be back trying to renegotiate this deal yet again. Even small, tiny countries like Sri Lanka relative to China have some leverage in these games. And we need to appreciate the utility of that leverage. And from a US perspective, if we're thinking competing with China, see their interest, the interests of smaller states, see their extreme interest in territorial sovereignty and some degree of autonomy as a means to help us sort of reach out to them and show that we can be a useful partner as they're dealing with the Chinese. That's an area of leverage that we should bring to the table increasingly as in our competition with China.
And Kishore, you had your hand up.
My question is about the Chinese leadership. China is basically a one-party country. So what happens with the leader makes a big difference in their policies. The current leader, Xi, nobody knew where he was for 2 weeks. Then he came back, became a leader. Everybody expects that his lifetime appointment means that he will be in power for a long time. What happens if he cannot retain power for a long time? Would there be power struggle like we had after Mao died? And what would that mean to the rest of the world?
It's a great question. And it points to what I think is a fairly heated debate among some China hands, those who are watching China leadership closely. And I think the debate is kind of the pendulum of this debate has broadly swung to one side. A piece of the debate is, are we seeing the true consolidation of power under Xi Jinping, or have we seen, or is it something else? In other words, is he the most powerful Chinese leader since Mao? Or is this, in fact, is he a reflection of the party's power? In other words, is this a one-man rule or is this still party rule? And I think that the pendulum, which had started with the notion that she was a product of the party and a reflection of the party, I think the pendulum has gradually swung in favor of the notion that he really is has consolidated personal control over Chinese politics in a way that we haven't seen for decades. So that's a piece of the puzzle. If that is true, then your question about what happens if he leaves opens up a Pandora's box of other potential outcomes, most of which, sitting outside the system or even sitting in Beijing, anywhere outside of the Communist Party, you'll have a nearly impossible time answering because this is such a closed system that even the most knowledgeable experts who are following reading every sort of the equivalent of Kremlinology, but now Beijingology, who are trying to interpret who shows up where in a given public event, who says what, who goes missing for, as you mentioned, Xi went missing, and that was not the only time that he's gone missing for a period of time. You know, what do these things mean? Parsing every word, every speech, to determine whether there's some change. All of that is happening, and yet there is no decisive understanding about what would happen, whether the party itself has actually been strengthened in a way, is more cohesive, and so would see a post-Xi moment as an opportunity to further consolidate the centrality of the party, to throw up another leader, and whoever that leader would be would simply assert control, or if it is a personalized rule, would then create an opportunity for a fragmentation of the party in ways that could be quite disruptive. We simply don't know. And, a number of stories every so often have popped up about even rumored coup attempts or assassination attempts. Sitting outside China, we really have trouble making sense of these things. One thing that I can say is that China's foreign policy has assumed the stamp of authority of President Xi Jinping, and everything, including the Belt and Road Initiative and everything associated with it, is perceived in China as basically untouchable in terms of public debate because it is so associated with his person and with his leadership. And so that strikes me as something that if we were to see his abrupt withdrawal from politics for one reason or another, we would immediately also have to ask, what is the consequence of this for China's more aggressive and more ambitious global agenda that has really taken shape under President Xi Jinping. Will China retrench from that because he's the principal driver? Or is this, in fact, a story of more kind of consistent and gradual Chinese involvement internationally that doesn't reflect Xi Jinping and his preferences so much as it reflects China's greater capability for doing things in the world? And this would have happened with or without him. But those are the kinds of open questions that would only be resolved in the moment. And I'm afraid I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't predict that one.
Dan, great presentation. I'd like to ask you a question that kind of gets into U.S. policy. There's an article in the New York Times this morning that talked about the passage of the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act in Congress, which passed 406-3, which shows the bipartisanship that characterizes our time, I guess. At the same time that this is happening, to push back against China and their policies in Xinjiang, U.S. companies, including Nike, Coca-Cola, even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, are lobbying fairly aggressively against measures like these. And I wonder if that sort of tells us that no matter what policy different countries follow, that global supply chains are quite resilient.
Yeah, great question. The example that comes to mind for me is the Disney movie Mulan. I don't know if you saw some of the stories that came out of that, but some of that was filmed in and around these parts of China and Xinjiang and so on. And the local security forces are even featured in the credits of the movie. And still, despite obvious public concern in the United States about, you know, the human rights abuses that are ongoing as reflected in congressional legislation, what price exactly does Disney pay for these types of choices? And clearly that hasn't been the principal driver for their business decisions. To the contrary, Disney, like many other companies that you've mentioned, continue to see China as essential to their bottom line and are likely to remain that way. Now, the word that I'm sure you've come across and maybe has been discussed before in this forum and others, decoupling, is really the question of the hour. That is, to what extent will the U.S. and Chinese economies find a way to separate themselves out on core issues? To what extent, and core technologies, while still benefiting from the interactions that they've had now over decades that have been so productive for so many people, both Chinese and Americans and everybody in between and all of their companies, how can we do both? And the past 4 years have not been a good example of a kind of trying to thread the needle carefully. This has been a much more sledgehammer approach. I would anticipate that the next 4 years will be spent trying to figure out which are the pieces of China's threat to the American economy, whether it's on human rights issues that you've just pointed out, or on security, surveillance, technological issues, intellectual property, and so on. And how can we, with more of a scalpel than a sledgehammer, as Obama used to say, separate on those issues? That's going to be the game that will be played. And it's really hard to do. Now, the key to doing so, I think, has more to do with, and this is where the Biden administration, I think, will likely start, and we'll see how much progress they can make, has mostly to do with how to get more of our partners in the world on board with such an agenda. So with respect to Xinjiang, if we're really upset, we, the United States, are really upset about what China is doing, whether it's with respect to forced labor or what looked like some version of concentration camps, then we should be banding together with our European allies and with other countries in the world and really coming up with very strict and tough measures, but directed toward those specific activities by China. Not things that would punish China as a whole, but things that would be really intended to get China to change track on its behavior in Xinjiang and Tibet and elsewhere with respect to human rights. And that has to be done in a unified way with a consistent message, a message that has not been consistent over the past 4 years because Congress has been speaking with one voice, the administration often with multiple voices, including at the highest levels. So that consistency hopefully will help. And the focus of the attention or the direction ideally would help even companies, big companies like the ones that you named, feel that they can still manage ways to do business with China and not be criticized at home or internationally for doing so, because they can disentangle their activities from the things that we're most upset about. That would be the goal. That is going to be harder and harder to do, especially when China, the other bit of news that's been very prominent in terms of Chinese policy over the past couple of weeks, has been its reaction to Australia. And it's taken a sledgehammer to Australia for its criticism of China, enacting tariffs and all kinds of other restrictions, and basically saying that Australia is not within its rights to criticize China on anything. Well, if that ends up being the Chinese reaction to the United States, then we're all going to be in a bind, because a narrow decoupling will be impossible under those circumstances. You know, if China feels that any criticism on Xinjiang or on human rights or anything is completely beyond the pale and responds in a truly bombastic manner, then all bets are off. And the kind of lobbying that these companies will be doing to Washington will be undermined by China's own messages. And their situation will be made that much more untenable.
First of all, I say I'm from Canada, so I empathize with Australia because China's doing the same thing to us.
Yep.
In particular, in relation to the vice president in Vancouver that the U.S. wants back. But in any event, the question I have relates to U.S. companies trying to compete with a state where the state has a dual goal. It has an economic goal, but it also has a strategic goal. And U.S. companies are trying to compete for some of those infrastructure projects around the world and the difficulty that that creates. And if you add to it corruption, which again, U.S. companies are often more constrained. And while the leadership of China says it's against corruption, how well are they able to regulate that in companies that would be operating in these countries where corruption is quite common?
Yeah, great question. And this is one of the hot topics that has received a lot of attention in the context of the Belt and Road Initiative, because of course, you know, as China has gone out, it's not just a matter of financing projects that are built, ultimately run and owned by other countries, third countries. It's a question of Chinese state-owned enterprises being financed to come into other countries and build and at least for a time operate, if not own, a lot of, you know, whether it's roads, maintaining those roads and so on, or more complicated things like power plants or telecommunications networks. These are the kinds of things that, you know, Chinese workers come in. China is effectively taking the loan from that company or that country to and possibly helping to supplement that with Chinese financing to pay a state-owned Chinese enterprise to do the work in that country, and the, you know, basically the money cycles back into Chinese pockets very quickly. Your concern about the competitiveness angle and about the corruption angle is one that, of course, has dominated a lot of the initial conversation. My reaction to that would be where China is building out in these countries projects that are ultimately white elephants or unlikely to pay dividends, somebody's going to be left holding a bag. This is going to either be China itself. So in some instances, what we've seen is Chinese financing effectively and, you know, projects don't work out. Already we're seeing this just within the past 5 to 7 years. And the question is, well, who's gonna pay? And, you know, is China gonna bail out these projects or not? So that's their problem. When it's the other countries, say Pakistan's has taken out the loans, then it becomes a broader problem, but then it becomes a political problem in these societies, because Pakistanis see that their state has taken out loans and cannot repay them. And now the question is, okay, this is very unpopular. Are we going to have to go back to the IMF for another bailout to help us pay off the Chinese and so on? And what this does is it creates the potential for significant rifts between China and these other countries. Now, that's problematic for them, but from an outside perspective, it's not entirely bad. It's sort of disruptive and potentially destabilizing, but it also reflects poorly on Chinese decisions and should help us in a broader kind of global competition for influence with China, should help us with these countries, have them see that, you know, we're not always the bad guy here. The Chinese can make some bad decisions too. And that takes me to my last point. Yeah, we're going to have a hard time with our commercial, private-led companies competing on any kind of a level playing field with the Chinese. We are not supposed to, and generally do not, feed into bribery and corruption in the same way as Chinese do, and so on. But what we've learned is, over the long run, that's smart. That actually is more sustainable, leads us into less trouble, and makes it less likely that locals who may be frustrated by us wanting to play by the rules initially, but over the long term, makes it less likely that they end up in corruption scandals that are deeply unpopular and tied to us. So I would say, let's try to have a little patience here. Not buy into the notion that the Chinese have now invented some new economic superpower that tool that enables them to do things that we wish we could do. And certainly that we shouldn't throw caution or our old practices out the window and mimic or ape the Chinese. That would be incredibly wasteful, particularly with respect to infrastructure. It would likely pay out poorly, certainly over the long term, in terms of our interests. And so I'm strongly against that. I think there are ways that we can do smart infrastructure and smart investment. And the Japanese are often leading the way with that. We can partner with them and others. That should be our angle. And we should look to other areas where we have advantages in these societies, everything from science to technology to education, and even arms sales, where we're still in all of those fields ahead of the Chinese and have a lot to offer, but they don't. And so let's play to our strengths rather than kind of lamenting ways in which they can play dirty. Because as I say, I think over time it will play poorly for them and benefit us.
Dan, you have given us so much to think about, and it really is clear that you need to come back.
So, I'd love to.
And we would love to have you come back, and we would love to have you here live. But I want to thank you so much for really an outstanding presentation. And as I said, there is so much more to learn. And each time you expand on the question, you open a door for even more. And that's great. That's what we all need to have to look forward to in the future.
Great. So glad. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. And this is a part of the world that I think we all need to pay a little more attention to as we go forward. But thank you.
Dan, on behalf of the 2,300 members of the Naples Council on World Affairs, but who's counting, but the 2,300 members, thank you for a really enlightening and thoughtful presentation.
Thank you.
You know, so often we see issues in the world in bipolar terms, and you remind us of the messy and complicated reality that really exists on the ground, that it was really super. So we thank you.
Thank you.